Hello, everyone. This is Flo from the Great War Channel podcast. And today I have a guest that you might have already known from our tank videos that we did last summer. This is David Willey. David, can you say hi to everybody and maybe tell a bit more about yourself for the people who haven't seen our tank episodes?
Yeah, certainly. As you say, my name is David Willey. I'm the curator at the Tank Museum in Bovington, which is down in the southwest of England. It's where the British Army came to train with tanks in World War One. It's been an army base ever since, and it's still where the British Army trains with tanks today. So they set up a teaching collection, and that's become the museum collection. We still have a teaching remit for the modern army, so we still have soldiers around the place, but we're also very much a public-facing visitor attraction nowadays. So we have lots of members of the public in. Fantastic collection, over 300 vehicles, and a superb collection of First World War tanks.
We highly recommend that you visit the Tank Museum. It's a great collection, not just about World War I tanks, but also about the general, I would say, progress and history of tank evolution, basically, starting from Little Willy, the first tank ever built, basically, until the 90s, actually, I think. And there is, if you're interested in visiting this, there is one special occasion this summer commemorating the Battle of Amiens in August, where we will be actually at the Tank Museum. And David, why don't you tell us a bit more about the Amiens event to get people excited so that they visit us there?
Yeah, okay. So in partnership with your good selves, on the 8th and 9th of August, we're going to be hosting an event here at the museum where we're going to put displays on outside. So you will be driving some of our replica First World War vehicles. We've got a nice A7V and a Mark IV replica First World War British tank. We'll also be inviting down some other museum collections to see what they can bring to help show off on that particular two-day event. And we're probably going to be getting hold of a Renault tank, an FT-17 that's just being restored. That will be coming along and showing off as well. Fingers crossed, everything goes to plan. So the idea is, why we've particularly chosen this event is, in Britain, there is a bit of a tendency, we look at 1918 as if somehow the war staggers to an end. And in Britain, we tend to go for November the 11th, the armistice, and that for us is our national day of remembrance. And you may well have seen all the images. We have the ceremony at the cenotaph. What I think we're trying to do with the Amiens event is draw attention to the fact of actually the defeat of the German army, which so often gets overlooked. And no doubt throughout the course of the year, you'll be looking at how different countries look at the end of the war, but also how propaganda, historical accident, all sorts of things have perhaps changed our view. And certainly in Britain, we have an issue about the Battle of Amiens that very few people know about it. The politics at the time were directing the press away from the Western Front, because we knew in Britain 1918 was going to be a tough year because of all the German armies coming back from the Russian front. We had the big attack that takes place earlier in the year. There's a falling out between Haig and Lloyd George. There's all sorts of things going on that means that even in 1918, we didn't know enough in Britain itself about the success of the Battle of Amiens for the British Army. And subsequently, through things such as Nazi propaganda, the stab in the back theory for the German army, that battle has kind of been overlooked. So one of the big reasons we're trying to draw attention to it is to redress that balance and show a period of World War One that so easily gets overlooked. We race on to November of 1918, then it's all about, understandably, loss, remembrance, thinking about the cost of the war. What we're trying to do is actually show a point in that war that very easily gets overlooked.
Yeah, that's certainly a very interesting and important point. That's why we also wanted to be on board. I mean, it's cool to see some tank replicas and to see the tanks in the museum and everything up close and in person. So that's already a good reason to come up. But generally talking about the Battle of Amiens, and also generally the year of battles, 1918, is super fascinating. I mean, we're currently covering the Kaiserschlacht and the German offensives up until May and everything. And sometimes when you read about it, it sounds like it's a completely different war. So it completely counteracts this kind of narrative that, as you said, the war just kind of dragged on and then it suddenly ended.
1918, for so many people, it really, if you like your history, and I imagine people listening to this podcast, your series on YouTube, it's one of these things that for so many people, were some people learning afresh, they're coming to this without any prejudices. Certainly there has been a period of historical writing that historians have been trying to change for perhaps the last 20, even 30 years. Very hard to get through the myths that we love to believe in Europe about the First World War, and perhaps see, you know, we're never going to be absolutely right. We're always going to have our bias. Yet at the same time, wouldn't it be better we get a fairer and more accurate view of what went on? And, you know, isn't it amazing? Look at Europe at the moment. Look at what we talk about, fake news. Look at how we deal with some of the issues going on around the world. Isn't that you can just see reflected in this period in World War One? What do people really believe? What's the facts of what's going on? And these were all issues going on in 1918. So hopefully during the course of the year, you know, with your podcast, with your broadcast, some of these areas that we perhaps naively overlook or sometimes have got a misbelief, we believe the myths are not necessarily perhaps more the truth, that those things can be teased out and we can look at anew. And certainly for us as well, there's what we've actually asked other museums in the UK to do with our Amiens event is, why don't you turn up with an interesting object to our event for those 2 days that you can explain, that you YouTubers, you know, you can talk about, you can have a look at, but for them symbolizes something about that year that's different to perhaps a popular perception. You know, this idea of the, dare I say it, you know, the war, we never want to make light of it in the wrong way. But all we ever tend to get in Britain is that sense of doom and gloom about 1918 and that struggle to the end. And it's been interesting. Some of the media in Britain has already picked up. The BBC has been criticised for saying it's almost like we lost the war. Actually, think of how Europe would have been if the Kaiser had won that war. Very different outcomes. So, you know, these are all some of the issues that it will be interesting to sort of see a little bit more talked about. And certainly, in an age of fake news, picking apart what nowadays, you know, now looking back, hang on, we've got much better evidence for perhaps a truer picture. I never want to say we've got the right picture, you know, because everyone's version is going to be very different. New information comes to light all the time. But it would be really good to see perhaps just a fairer picture get reflected.
I mean, I absolutely agree. So if you're interested in coming to the Amiens event, we will put a link into the description of this podcast, and of course we will make a proper announcement video and everything on the YouTube channel. You won't be able to miss out on this event. Highly encourage you to come. And now I think we should talk about some tanks. What do you think about that?
Okay, you're far away. What would you like to know about tanks?
Okay, so maybe also for the people that I mean, we already made a bit of an episode called Tanks, the Adolescent Years, but maybe you can recap a bit more. Where was the tank corps in early 1918? Like how from where did they come from, September 1916 to that point? I mean, it's like 2 years, of course, but or 1.5 years. But where are we now?
So we all know the first tank attack, September 1916, the end of the Somme battles. Just under 50 tanks are available. They're not that successful. But the British commander-in-chief, Haig, sees their potential. He orders 1,000 of them. They have struggles, as so many countries do, in putting new technology together, getting it tested, getting manufacturing space. Tanks are used the following year at the Battle of Arras in the spring of 1917. Not greatly successful, but they do see some role there. We're still building. We're trying to build better tanks. We come up with the Mark I tank is in use at the first battle. The Mark IV is the tank they make the most of in World War I in Britain. They make just over 1,000 of them. They're starting to be ready by later in the summer of 1917. But they're used at the Battle of Passchendaele to not great success. The Passchendaele, as we all know, the landscape, the weather, very boggy ground, tanks just sink in the mud. And the Tank Corps is very depressed about their future because they are, you know, costly items, tanks. They're taking skilled men, they're training them, they're getting them to use this new weapon system. They don't seem to be getting the effect that really this investment warrants. So the Tank Corps come up with the idea of having a raid at a place called Cambrai on the Western Front in November of 1917 as a way of perhaps vindicating themselves before the winter sets in. Let's find a way of showing off. And that raid is built up by Haig into the idea this could be a breakthrough. They use all the tanks available in an initial assault. They use a very clever artillery system that we're picking up on. We're getting very good with our artillery in Britain at this stage, so that there is a bombardment suddenly on the German front line without lots of pre-registration. In other words, lots of fire to let you know something's coming. They are using air power in a really imaginative way. They actually call it air artillery. So the planes fly over and they're actually strafing the German front lines as at dawn on 21st of November, off go this massive tank fleet into the attack. And they cut about a 3 mile wide hole in the German front line. Very successful, one or two holdups on that day. It, unfortunately for the British, breaks down relatively quickly into attritional warfare again. And then the Germans, being the Germans, do a stunning counterattack that wipes out this advance that's been made. The key issue about it, though, is tanks are back on the agenda in a big way. The German reaction is, hang on a second, there's no such thing now as a quiet sector of the front line. That's their nervousness to that. The full potential of the tank is at last, they're starting to see that, and certainly the British High Command not only sees it, Haig's been behind the tanks, but it starts disseminating throughout the rest of the army. This new weapon has got more than just a little bit of potential. This really can do something. And tanks in terms of production, after November, before November, they're pretty low down. We're looking at things such as aeroplanes, guns, ammunition, transport, trains are all ahead of tanks in terms of priority of production. After Cambrai, that swaps around. Suddenly tanks get moved up the agenda more. And the idea again is for 1918, in many ways, psychologically, in the West, we're waiting for the Americans to turn up. But even Petain says the way he sees what's coming. And he says, look, we're going to hang on and wait for the Americans and the tanks. And a massive tank building program is underway. And that sort of, you know, the emphasis behind those tanks for 1918 goes up the agenda. Now, at the beginning of the year, Britain and the Western Allies, we know the Germans are going to be putting in their spring attack. We know they're going to be doing this massive advance. Dates are debated. We finally realize it's probably going to be about the 21st of March is going to be the main attack coming, certainly on the British sector. They start thinking, number one is, what are the Germans going to be doing? Are they going to have tanks? We've got intelligence information that Germans may be building tanks. We now know, of course, Germany only builds about 20 A7B tanks of their own design, but they've captured at least 40 Mark IV tanks at Cambrai, and the Germans call them Beutepanzers or booty panzers. They put them back into service. They train up crews. They do some slight changes to them. But those vehicles we know might be coming at us as well. So they start for the first time. The British are now starting to think, how might we deal with tanks attacking us as opposed to the other way around? And that winter, there's an awful lot of clever ideas, dumb ideas, all sorts of things are going on where they're thinking, how might we stop tanks? And they give the problem to the Tank Corps. They say, look, you guys know about tanks. What are we going to do? How are we going to come up with ideas? So various things are discussed. They come up with the idea of using the current tanks in British service as a way of defending. And Ellis, the guy in charge of the Tank Corps, he comes up with this idea called that they come out with Savage Rabbits, which the idea is hide tanks in positions near the front line, wait for the German attack. Then these tanks in small packets will emerge and this idea of Savage Rabbit, like it's a rabbit coming out of its hole and starts going for your ankles. So they would actually attack from flank or side or even rear positions as the German army advanced. So the tank corps is spread out along about a 60-mile frontage. So, you know, they're spread fairly thinly. Some of the tank corps guys think this is wrong because you're losing the strength of the tanks by putting them in smaller penny packets. So they're not being kept all together. When the German attack comes in, those guys were probably proven to be right, because we think only half of the tanks that actually were put aside waiting to do counterattacks actually get into action at all. Many of them, because of the success of the German initial advance, many of those tanks are end up being abandoned. They don't get enough supplies getting through to them. They are in positions of confusion where they either attack, they're then told to retreat. We've got situations where tanks are being abandoned or set on fire by their own crews. So initially we lose an awful lot of vehicles during that first part of the German attack. There are one or two successes. There's occasions where the tanks prove absolutely brilliant at holding up the German advance to give the chance of the British soldiers to reform a line, take a position, etc. And even Ellis himself, again, as head of the tank corps, there's one particular engagement where near a place called Collingcamp, where he himself personally goes ahead of what was considered the British front line to start looking for positions, to rally troops, to have his tanks patrol up and down to stop the Germans advancing. And again, in terms of leadership, you know, we sometimes overlook this, inspirational leadership. Ellis himself says, we better go and find out where the Germans are. And literally him and a fellow officer are now going and looking down a village, knocking on the doors of houses, trying to work out how far the Germans have got to. That's how chaotic the situation was during that German advance in March and early April. Part of the Savage Rabbit attacks leads to the first ever tank-on-tank engagement. Yeah, so at Villers-Bretonneux, some of the British tanks that have been spread out, we've got about a couple of Mark IV tanks, female ones, and one male Mark IV tank. So the female tanks just have the machine guns. The Germans, for the first time, are using about three A7V tanks as part of a series of attacks around Villers-Bretonneux. And for the first time, these tanks in the Savage Rabbit role, the British ones come out of hiding, down the across the other side of the field, coming towards them, are three A7Vs. Now, depending on whose accounts you read, you can either call this fight at best a draw. The British commander at one point, he actually seemed to think really the Germans had the day. But what happens is the two female tanks, so the British ones are engaged by the A7Vs, they're knocked out. The Mark IV tank, with the larger six-pounder guns on, then manages to come into action, disables one of the A7Vs, and the other two A7Vs then sort of retreat off the battlefield. At the end of the day, both sides go back onto the battlefield to recover their tanks. So you could almost call it a draw. But on that very same day as well, some Whippet tanks then engage a bit later on, and they actually meet some A7Vs as well. So you're looking at, for the first time, obviously it's something that we now tend to look back on and think as tanks fighting tanks. This is the first time it happens on the 24th, 25th of April at Villers-Bretonneux. That's the first proper tank-on-tank engagement. And it's one of those other areas where, for the British, what they're trying to do all the time with this new weapon is learning how to use it better, what might be successful, and they are very good at disseminating that information. For a British tank crew, as soon as you come back after an engagement, the commander, normally a second lieutenant, has to write up what happened and any suggestions he can make. And that goes back to this, so it's disseminated. Everyone can start saying, we think we're learning lessons about this. We don't want to make the same mistakes again. We don't want to find our tanks not being used to their full effect. And again, that idea of the first tank engagement, obviously amazing resonance through history, because, you know, that's the first time. And of course, these guys who are dealing with this are making it up as they go along. This is new tactics, new actions. What do we do about it? And of course, you know, the sight of the A7V is quite something for the British. You know, this is quite a big vehicle, relatively fast vehicle on open roads. Firepower we don't know about. We're you know, all these things they're learning as they're going along.
And I mean, it has a forward-facing machine guns and everything. And I mean, even though the tank corps guys might be used to seeing a tank by now, most of the infantry might still think it's a fairly new thing.
Yeah, and you've got this other big problem, of course, is where the Germans are using our captured Mark IV and later Mark V tanks against the British. Is it one of ours? Is it an enemy tank? You know, when do we open fire? So you've got that confusion that can take place as well. And of course, again, the tactics now are changing. So with the German infiltration tactics, you know, the miss that happens to be there on the first day of their march attack, this idea of you've got accounts of both sides trying to find where the other enemy are on a battlefield where sometimes it's missed, sometimes it's smoke shells, sometimes it's gas shells that are cleverly rained down together to help confuse people. So the idea of who really is the enemy, hence the Germans doing the Maltese cross on the side of their vehicles, and then the British deciding to put banding, red and white banding, on the tops and the front horns of their vehicles so that they're more readily identified as being of the Allied side and not a British tank that's been captured and used by the Germans. And the Germans in the same position. If you're a German tank crew, you're pretty nervous about being fired on by your own batteries that may well be confusing you for a British tank.
Okay, so I made a few mental notes in your summary now. That was excellent, by the way. I love listening to that. So the first thing I was thinking about, the savage rabbit tactic, I mean, it's certainly something rather unusual for our mental image of World War One. I mean, it already hints towards the evolution away from trench warfare and everything. You specifically highlighted that they want to attack from the flank and even from the rear, because I would assume this was something that they already realized were the weak points of the tanks at the time. I mean, the A7V, for example, also has much stronger frontal armor than on the sides or in the rear.
Well, it's also about they were looking at the tactics, how they thought they were going to defend, knowing the Germans with their new, you know, what have we got, over 30 divisions coming all the way back from the Eastern Front. The British have a problem as well, is they're being starved of men. There's a political issue going on between Lloyd George and Haig. Haig is fed up with, Lloyd George is fed up with Haig, really, in the sense that he doesn't want to supply more men because he thinks they are being wasted. After the Passchendaele battles, Lloyd George has lost confidence in Haig as the British commander-in-chief. Haig is crying out for men to help defend what for him is an extended line. They've now actually taken over 40 miles extra of the French front line. So not only is his troops being stretched, he's not being reinforced in the way that he wants to be. So they think of new tactics of how they might try and slow the German military when they are going to be attacked. They know that attack's coming. The Germans are obviously under pressure to put a major attack in before the Americans start arriving in numbers that are going to affect the outcome. The Americans are turning up. They're a naive bunch. They're new. They're needing to train. They are not going to be. Pershing is insisting almost on a year to get them up to speed before they can engage properly. So on the Western Front, the Allies are bracing themselves for that German attack. Now, as part of that bracing themselves, they're looking, what's the best way to defend? So they come up with this idea of a sort of staggered defense. You have an outpost line, which is like the trigger line for when the enemy's coming towards you. You then have a line of resistance behind that, where we're channeling that advancing German forces. And by channeling them, we're trying to sort of say, here's where we're going to put the barbed wire. Here's when we're going to put the minefields. Here's how we're going to try and get any advancing German force into an area that then becomes the third line, which is what they call the battle zone, where it's almost like the backstop. This is where we should be defeating the enemy by. Now, the problem Haig's got is he hasn't got enough men to man that defensive system in as effective a way as possible. He's looking at where can I put my tanks as to help defend. Now, there was one argument you should put those tank forces together as an effective mobile reserve to wait to see where the German attack is being most successful and then maneuver it to where that attack is taking place. The problem is you've then got the issue of maneuvering Mark IV tanks, and the Mark V's are just starting to start appearing. You're going to have to put them on railway flats to maneuver them to wherever you think that breakthrough is. And are we actually going to be able to do that in time? So the decision is made. No, let's just spread them out. Let's try and do them. So, and again, that phrase, savage rabbits, they're in small pockets to be able to come out and hopefully influence the battle as those German forces are coming forward. So whether it's they're waiting either till they get through the line of resistance or the battle zone, that then they can engage, hopefully, as they see it, from hidden positions, from onto the flank of advancing German columns, etc., and do the damage that way. Now, as we know from what actually happens, that works in one or two areas, but in a lot of areas, the tanks emerge, there is massive confusion because of the nature of the German attacks using these stormtroop tactics, infiltrating all the way through, so that the, fantastically for the Germans, missed on the morning of the attack, confusion reigns, and then in essence, a British collapse going on, and that German advance. So the number of times these tanks actually have the opportunity of doing what they were intended to do. One or two places, they do it brilliantly. In a number of places, there's some tanks driving around till they run out of petrol, and then the crews end up having to take out the Lewis guns, and they end up fighting as Lewis gun teams, trying to slow the German advance or to bolster the British lines.
So, okay, that was one aspect. And one more thing about the flanking. You already just talked about, I would call it one of the underdogs of World War One tanks, which is the Whippet tank, which we should, by the way, film an episode about when we visit in summer.
So one of the issues the British have been looking at, there's the tank building program that's been going on in the background. They've got, by October about 1917, there's about 700 Mark IV tanks have been delivered. They've got another 500 on the production line that are due to come. You've got 1,600 new tanks ordered. This is a big production line. And that ability, and again, we're looking at, you know, if you look strategically, the overview, one of the reasons the Germans don't go for the A7V tank in such a way, they consider it such a cost, such an engineering problem, and, you know, the manufacturing space, time and energy, would that material be better used elsewhere? That's one of the reasons the Germans are fairly slow off the mark. They just don't rate the tank in the way that the Western allies are putting huge amounts of resource in. And of course, by this stage of the war, the blockade is biting on the German home front as well. So the actual availability of some of the materials that are wanted, much argument going on there. Now, there's about 385 Whippet tanks are due to be delivered by May the 1st, 1918. Now, the Whippet has been designed fairly early on, and the idea being is, do you have what nowadays we might call a fast or a cavalry tank? The idea behind it is a rhomboid-shaped tanks can do the damage, cross the wire down, allow the infantry to advance. In the back of our minds, it's been the cavalry will be the arm of exploitation. They will be going through the gap to cause the damage. That's traditionally how it's been viewed. But already they're thinking perhaps an armoured vehicle that can go faster and cause problems behind the front line as a weapon of exploitation. Along with, of course, they're looking at armoured cars, and they're now bringing armoured cars in 1918 to the Western Front, Austins, Rolls-Royces, etc., with the idea that if we are in a position of exploitation, the guys on horseback, great when they can get through, but if there's still a bit of barbed wire, still some machine guns left, we may need an armoured vehicle to go off and do the damage. And the Whippet, there's some wonderful examples in 1918 where Whippet tanks have that opportunity and they take it up. Now, after they've to look at, you know, just to put in a little bit more of a time concept, the Whippet, 8 miles an hour. It has two Tyler engines in the front. The driver has a real problem because basically what he's trying to do is he speeds up one of those engines to turn the track on one side around faster. And if he puts the speed up on one track, it basically will push you round the corner, the other track going slower. So that's how you actually drive along and steer, by speeding up an engine. This is complex for a driver to get this right. He's also got the problem that the cab space, or the barbette that's behind the engine that contains Hotchkiss machine guns, it has two other crew members in that space, a commander and a gunner. That will get very, very hot very quickly inside that space. So if you look at all the photographs of Whippets driving around, if they're not in combat, the rear door is always left open to let air circulate. It is not a what we would now call a very well ergonomically designed vehicle. At the same time, going at 8 miles an hour, twice the speed of things like the Mark IV and the Mark V tank, that it means it's fast. So it can do the role of the cavalry at certain times. By being armoured, it can go off, and it does cause problems behind the German front line. And later in the summer, after the attack in there's an attack at Hamel, and then Amiens in August, a tank called Musical Box goes off driving around. It's a Whippet tank called Musical Box. And if you read the litany of what it's able to do behind the German front line, it shoots up a railway train coming in as with German resupply troops. It drives off and knocks down a barrage balloon. An observation balloon is being used. It drives, it causes mayhem behind the front line, exactly as it was planned to do. So the Whippet's another one of those vehicles where it sees action in 1918, but perhaps its potential, again, with a lot of the theorizing that's going on with the tank corps in 1918, they're looking at really how they're going to deal with the German army in 1919 with these massive production numbers, bigger, let's get together with the French and the Americans, we're going to make this international tank. There's a whole host of other issues coming together. They have to put a number of those on the back burner whilst they look after the German attack. So that means training, lots of other things go out the window early in the spring. By the summer, though, they're using these tanks that they already have got to great effect at the Battle of Hamel in the summer of 1918. You've got this brilliant exercise with Monash and the in charge of the Australian troops, and he's training with General Courage of the 5th Tank Corps. And what they do is they do a brilliant bit of let's get to know each other, let's train with each other, let's trust each other, let's make sure everybody, we're going to put an Australian soldier in the back of most of these tanks so that they can act as liaison, go out, have a beer with each other. They, because of the Australians from Buller Corps, they've got very little trust in the tanks. Now they learn to love the tanks. And at Hamel, they do an attack that goes brilliantly well. Very successful. The Australians lose very few men comparatively. We only lose a few tanks. They're learning from that. And the tank corps as well is also learning we can do things quicker than we expected. Combray, they thought was amazing because they managed to plan the battle, get all the logistics together in a month. Amiens, they do it in 2 weeks. And they realize this is what's called rather boringly staff work. But they understand now, if we can move tanks, we can get the petrol there, we can do all these different things much, much quicker. And that's really what kicks off on the 8th and 9th of August with Amiens. We get all our tanks together, but not only do we do a successful tank attack, and it's a great breakthrough leading to the German army to start retreating, but they can very quickly say, actually, we're bogging down here, let's maneuver our tanks quickly to another sector and carry on an attack elsewhere. So that sense of being much more flexible in how they're using the equipment they've got, they're not doing quite the set piece battle in the same way, they're being able to maneuver that. And again, these are things that I think it even surprises the British at how quickly this is going on. And the problem, of course, for historians and even the British Army and certainly the press at the time, is the success of Amiens is almost being overlooked because of other political issues, but also it's happening so fast that even the journalists can't keep up with where that fighting's going on that day. What's going on? The confusion, the fact that no one quite knows what's going on all the time. Are the Germans still there? After all this static warfare, this sudden breakout warfare is something very, very new. And again, you know, Haig has prefigured this. He's seen some of this coming. He's already been going back to the to Lloyd George in London and War Office saying, listen, we're going to need more automobiles. We're going to need those armoured cars because we may well be getting back to 1914 again, a sense of mobile warfare. And the technology's moved on. It's not just a man on a horse. They're still very valid, but maybe it might be guys in an armoured car or a truck or with some tanks that actually can exploit this. So that sense, there is no two ways about it. It's a confusing period for all the parties in the sense of how trying to follow how the battles actually develop. We don't have that nice, or, you know, let's tidy everything up and we'll reset again, ready for the following month. It doesn't happen that way. It's literally within a day or two, they're being able to change around and use their new tactics. And again, that idea, we often talk about Cambrai, it's kind of trying to use those all-armed tactics. Now they're brilliantly using things such as aeroplanes, squadrons of aeroplanes are actually allocated to certain tank battalions so they know how each other are working. The tanks are being signaled by the aeroplanes. Aeroplanes are dropping messages to the tanks. You know, this level of cooperation is happening remarkably well in from August onwards and in some of the September battles that is leading to that German retreat. And that's one of the other things, you know, we talked about earlier about why that importance of Amiens. Look, that is a defeat of the German army in the field, still respected in the West as the most professional, the best army, best training. They're the ones that are actually now retreating off the battlefield. And, you know, as the Kaiser said, you know, our guys are just not ready to stand up to tanks. He's asking that almost as a question to Ludendorff at one point. He's puzzled by this idea. So it's always a tricky one. I'm at the Tank Museum. We're going to talk about tanks, aren't we? Did they really have that massive effect? It's really hard putting a balance on 1918. Did they make a difference? It's so interesting, I think, in so many of the German memoirs. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, Petain saying, you know, we're going to wait for the Americans and the tanks. That idea that psychologically these things are making perhaps more of an impact. There's not that many there. They break down very quickly still. We know, you know, very quickly after a day's action, you're very lucky if at the end of the day you've got half your tank force still available. But they are part of this psychological impact of what you might call the Allies' material superiority. Tactically, in some areas, they make a huge difference. There's not enough to, you know, really swamp the battlefield. The French are starting to come on with their FT tanks, but again, still in small numbers. The Americans are just training. August, they leave Bovington with their first heavy tank battalion ready that they've been training here at Bovington. The French have been training with some FT tanks with the Americans. You know, they're not there in numbers. We can't claim the tank is swinging it, but to underrate their psychological importance, I think, would also be a failure. And that, in so many of the memoirs, that word about comes out at certain times about, you know, the impact if you're a German soldier at the time. And, you know, there's lines as well. It's not just the tanks there. It's when they do capture some American prisoners. One of the German officers at the time, he just looks at the equipment the American soldier's wearing, the thickness of the leather on the American soldier's holster. He just looks at that and he said, it's like a kick in the pants for our morale. These guys have got everything. And it's the quality they're coming with. You know, the fact that these young farm boys, you know, well fed, everything else, when you've been a country at war that's been quietly blockaded, starved, etc. So it's another one of those areas, you know, very hard to put on a graph. We can say how many tanks are available, but charting morale and charting what that impact has on different people is much, much harder, you know, and also it's just not true for a whole army. You know, you've got bits of the military that are still fighting superbly, that have been very, very brave, being very sacrificial. You've got other bits of military on both sides that, you know, we've had enough. We've, you know, the French military as well is basically from its mutinies in 17, you know, they're in many areas, they're still saying, look, we will defend, but we're not going to attack. So that impact across 1918, different times we're seeing different elements of it. We're seeing new technology still come in. It is a very mixed picture, but, you know, for me at the moment, talking about tanks are there. They're almost a symbol of how the Western Allies, with its material advantage, are being used to crush what is now an exhausted German military.
Well, I think it's also fascinating to talk about it, and it's fascinating to listen to you. I certainly could listen to it all day, and currently also reading a bit about the German side of it, some German sources. There will be more about that on our show, of course. As we said, much more details about tanks. Tanks actually rolling in front of you at the Amiens event this summer. David, thank you. Thanks a lot. If you can't get enough of David, the Tank Museum Bovington actually has a YouTube channel where they have a format called Tank Chats, where you just examine the King Tiger. So you should, of course, also check that out. I mean, you can never learn enough about tanks, can you? I will put a link to that in the podcast description. Again, David, thanks a lot for that. That was fascinating. And we will see each other this summer.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Thank you to all your listeners. And we really do hope you try and make the effort. Come and meet the guys at the Amiens event, 8th and 9th of August, here at the Tank Museum. Otherwise, say hello if you come at any other time. Do have a look at those YouTube ones as well. And well done with the series. And well done for, I'd say, telling so many people about a war that is still so misunderstood by so many. So I'd like to think that by the end of this series, you guys will have educated an awful lot more people. In you know, we won't know everything, there's still things to find out, but they're going to be able to look at those stories with perhaps a new eye, and you know, and boy, learning from our history is so important.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And if a few people actually, you know, do learn more about the war, that's all we ever wanted to do when we started this. So thanks a lot, David. Bye bye.
Bye bye.